This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be talking with international human rights lawyer Reed Brody on how the United States, specifically James Bolton, Trump's advisor, is attacking the International Criminal Court and destroying the rule of law. We'll also be talking with human rights attorney for Greenpeace, Deepa Padmanabhan, on the attack against Greenpeace and 17 other organizations by the extreme right because of their activity in preserving the planet.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
On September 10th in Washington, D.C., President Donald Trump's recently appointed National Security Advisor John Bolton gave an important and widely publicized speech to the Rightist Federalist Society, threatening the International Criminal Court judges and court personnel if they dared to probe into the USA's torture practices in Afghanistan and three European black sites. These charges have been documented by the U.S. Senate in its report of December 14, 2017. The International Criminal Court, the ICC, is also investigating Israeli war crimes in Gaza, where in 2014, more than 3,000 people, including over 500 children, were killed by Israeli invaders. This has been documented by the United Nations Goldstone Report. Bolton said that, quote, "The United States will use any means necessary to protect our citizens and those of our allies from unjust prosecution by this illegitimate court, including tariffs and prosecutions." He added that, quote, "If the court comes after us, Israel or other allies, we will not sit quietly." Bolton also announced that the U.S. is shutting down a Palestinian diplomatic office in Washington, D.C., because Palestinians have indicated that the ICC prosecute America's ally Israel for war crimes and crimes against humanity. In addition, the United States has cut off payments to the United Nations organization that has provided funds for refugees displaced by Israel when it conquered Palestine both in 1948 and then thereafter in the 1967 war. These funds were used for schools and hospitals in the West Bank and Gaza. We speak today with international human rights attorney Reed Brody. A former colleague of Michael Ratner, Brody has spent much of his career prosecuting international war criminals for war crimes that the International Criminal Court investigators are contemplating with respect to the United States and Israel. Reed, it's really nice to see you and have you back on Law and Disorder. I wanted to begin our discussion by asking you about the International Criminal Court, the ICC. What is it? When it was formed? Who are the members? What does it do?
Sure. Well, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, was established at a conference in Rome 20 years ago. I was at that conference to prosecute the worst cases of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, when nations are either unwilling or unable to prosecute those crimes themselves. And actually, the ICC is a kind of a continuation of the Nuremberg idea that the authors of the worst international crimes should be prosecuted.
And Nuremberg trials, of course, were the trials arranged after World War II, but specifically not to bring about victors' justice, but to set the stage for international law.
Exactly. And so you had French, Russian, English, and American judges who were trying the Nazi leadership. And the idea was never again. But of course, the paralysis of the Cold War made it so that, you know, in the ensuing years, if you were a Somoza or a Marcos or an Idi Amin or a Mao or a Stalin, you know, you were more likely to die in bed than to be prosecuted. And then you had the twin genocides in Rwanda and Yugoslavia, and the international community's failure to stop them, and you know, the decision was made to create first a tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and then a tribunal for Rwanda. And with the end of the Cold War, the idea of an ICC, of a permanent ICC, went back on the table. And so that's where you get to the Rome Conference 20 years ago. Now, the ICC is one, probably the most important part of this new architecture of international justice that we can talk about.
Who are the members of the ICC, and what can it do?
Well, the ICC, I actually think it's about 125 states, not including, though, the United States, China, Russia, also India, Pakistan, some of the most important countries in the world. Most of the, you know, I was in Rome, the largest block of countries are actually African, but you also have most of Latin America, most of Europe are parts of the part of the ICC. So the ICC is a court, though, of limited jurisdiction. So it only, first of all, it only has jurisdiction to try crimes that occurred since the statute went into effect, which I think was 2002, as well as only crimes on the territory of states that have ratified the treaty, or individuals of countries who've ratified the treaty. So if an American commits, you know, genocide in America, that doesn't count because America, the United States, is not a party to the ICC. However, and well, this is where the whole Afghanistan comes in, Afghanistan is a party to the ICC. And so if non-Afghanis commit, you know, war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity on the territory of Afghanistan, the ICC is competent.
Well, that leads me to my next question. In 2003 and 2004, when George Bush was the president, the CIA and the United States military invaded Afghanistan and tortured people there. This was against American law and international law. And although President Obama admitted that, and this is what he said, quote, "We tortured some folks," he did nothing about it. And famously, he said, "We have to look forward, not backward." In 2014, the United States Senate issued a report documenting this torture. Nothing was done. Then in 2016, in a preliminary report, the ICC made allegations of crimes committed by Americans in Afghanistan as a matter of policy in the early years of that war. This included torture, cruel treatment, and rape. Do you view the ICC as a court of last resort with respect to prosecuting torturers?
Well, I think that's precisely what it is. You know, many of us, I, on behalf of Human Rights Watch, I actually wrote several reports. The most recent one was called Getting Away with Torture, which looked at the case against U.S. policymakers, including George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, George Tenet, and others, for torture, for war crimes, for illegal renditions. And as you said, many people, most recently the Senate Select Committee, have documented, you know, medieval practices, torture, you know, people hanging up by their thumbs, people frozen to death by U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And those, you know, were not the result of just the work of a few bad apples. I mean, as we have shown, others have shown, you know, these were the results of, you know, President Bush himself signed off on waterboarding. George Tenet, CIA director, signed off on the rendition of you know, of suspects to, or not even of people, of suspects to countries where they were tortured, the use of secret prisons. In our work, when we go to other countries, we say, you know, if people have been accused credibly of torture, we ask those countries to prosecute. And the United States really has to do the same. And if the United States does not prosecute these crimes, it opens up for others to do so, not just the International Criminal Court. I mean, Michael Ratner, our great late and sorely missed friend, was part of an effort to file cases for U.S. torture in before the courts of places like France and Germany and Spain, which could exercise universal jurisdiction, the Pinochet principle. If the United States will not prosecute these crimes, which can be considered in some instances crimes against humanity, then any country has the right and sometimes the obligation to prosecute those crimes.
2 months ago, CIA operative Gina Haspel was appointed as the head of the CIA. She was known as Bloody Gina in CIA circles. She ran a torture site in Yugoslavia. Michael Ratner warned that unless the torturers were brought to justice, there was a danger that it would be repeated. Your thoughts on this?
Well, that's right. The site was actually in Thailand that...
I apologize.
It's okay, that Gina Haspel ran. We know that people were waterboarded in that site. We know that Gina Haspel participated or was at the origin of the decision to destroy the evidence and tapes of those sessions. You know, there's a saying that impunity breeds contempt for the law. And, you know, it's one thing for President Obama to have said, you know, we're not going to torture. But as David Cole said, it's like leaving a loaded gun on the table. You're not going to pick it up. But you say, well, the other guy picked up it. I'm not going to do it. But the next guy can do it. And so it becomes just a question of policy. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? When in fact, it's a question of law. It is illegal under American law, under international law, to torture people, to waterboard people, to put people in the situations that Gina Haspel put them in, to put people in the situations that we're describing from some of these, you know, salt pits and mines in Afghanistan.
What about Trump's recently appointed advisor, John Bolton? Bolton said regarding the ICC, the Court of Last Resort, he said 2 weeks ago, he said that the United States will use any means necessary to protect our citizen in those and those of our allies from an unjust prosecution by this illegitimate court. That's what he calls it, an illegitimate court. He said that the United States would, quote, respond against the ICC and its personnel to the extent that the United States law permits. And how do you explain this aggressive hostility?
Well, this is for John Bolton nothing new because he led the George W. Bush attack on the ICC. You know, I think there is a philosophical question, first of all, which is, you know, how the international, how we best protect ourselves and the world. And, you know, the John Bolton view, the traditional view even of the Pentagon is that the United States is best protected by being the strongest guy on the block. And he said that. He actually quoted, I didn't quote, but he referred to Franklin Roosevelt saying, you know, the way to protect the world from atrocities is through the might of America and its allies. Now, leaving aside the times that America and its allies actually commit those atrocities, the question is, if you're the biggest bully in the schoolyard, well, you probably think that's the way you get protected, by being the biggest bully in the schoolyard. Other people might say it's by having rules that say you can't beat other people up. And if you do, you get punished for that. And so I think there's a fundamental question. The U.S., John Bolton, but not only John Bolton, you know, believe that, you know, we should not have a bunch of, you know, Swedish and Senegalese judges looking over the shoulders of American policymakers, American people who are targeting for bombing, that our decisions should be based on American national choices, not on, you know, the rule of law. And so within that flexibility that the U.S. wants to defend its national interests includes the flexibility of doing things that other people, not just other people, that judges, that the law would consider to be war crimes. And, you know, so I think that, you know, you have this fundamental question. John Bolton in particular, and what particularly, of course, rankles not just John Bolton, but also I have to say that, you know, back to the Clinton administration, which let's remember when the International Criminal Court statute was adopted in Rome in 1998, the U.S. was one of seven countries that voted against it under the Clinton administration. And one of the reasons the U.S. voted against it was precisely because it felt that the court should not have jurisdiction over citizens of non-state parties like the United States, even when they commit war crimes on the territory of state parties like Afghanistan. The U.S. says, we didn't sign this treaty. You can't prosecute our citizens. Well, you know, first of all, if the Afghan government could prosecute them theoretically. So the Afghan government has, in a sense, by ratifying the ICC treaty, said, you, the ICC, can prosecute these crimes.
Bolton denounced the ICC, as we've said, as illegitimate. He said it was ineffective and unaccountable and outright dangerous and contrary to American principles. He said, we will provide no assistance to the ICC. We will not join the ICC. We will let the ICC die on its own. After all, the ICC is almost dead to the U.S. Do you think that the ICC is illegitimate? And just what are the American principles?
Well, it's certainly not illegitimate when you have, you know, the majority of the world's countries who have ratified it, when you have, you know, the backing of the ICC is not part officially of the UN, but when you have, you know, the backing of the international community. You know, the principle here is, you know, that these are crimes or alleged crimes that have been well defined in international law, to which states have, you know, appointed and created the ICC as a court of last resort. One of the things that the ICC would and will look at in the case of Afghanistan, because it is a court of last resort, is whether or not the United States is addressing these crimes. I mean, this was traditionally the end. Well, the traditional response was, well, you don't have to prosecute these crimes because we're prosecuting them here in the United States. Except that in this case, as we know, almost no one, for all of the Abu Ghraibs and all of the secret prisons and all of the Guantanamos and all of the salt pits in Afghanistan, almost nobody has been prosecuted.
Bolton said that the United States would, quote, respond against the ICC and its personnel to the extent permitted by U.S. law. He threatened that we will ban its financial system and will prosecute them in the United States criminal system. We will do the same for any country or any state that assists the ICC's investigation of Americans. He said the United States would retaliate against countries who assist the ICC by withholding foreign assistance, military assistance, and intelligence sharing. Do you think the ICC is in danger if it goes forward and prosecutes?
You know, interestingly, I mean, I think the ICC is in a fragile position in general. I mean, John Bolton is certainly right that it has been largely ineffective. You know, spent between $1.5 and $2 billion and has gotten 8 convictions. I mean, I've done better than that in my own practice, as have others. I think, as my friend Thierry Cruvelier said in the New York Times this week, that the attack by Bolton may actually help revive the ICC in a sense, because, you know, traditionally, you know, the ICC has, you know, been focusing on smaller states, on African states. One of the criticisms that I and many others have, not just the U.S., but the U.S., Russia, China, and all of the people who are protected. So the U.S. protects Israel, China protects, you know, Sri Lanka and North Korea, Russia protects Syria. So there's a whole part of there's a whole kind of no accountability area that the ICC cannot reach because those countries are being protected by Security Council members. Because we should have mentioned that the other way a country can come before the ICC, in addition to ratifying the treaty, is if the Security Council refers it. Now, interestingly, John Bolton says the court is dead to the U.S., but the U.S. was a member of the Security Council when the Security Council referred the case of Darfur to the ICC. The U.S. was a member of the Security Council when the U.S. referred the case of Gaddafi to the ICC. So, you know, the U.S.'s position has traditionally been accountability for everybody but us and our allies. And that's the position of Russia and China as well.
Do you think that Bolton and the Trump administration generally, that their threats to target specific ICC officers represents a new realm of hostility against international law?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say we're not going to participate. It's another thing to say we're going to prosecute you all. Now, first of all, I think it's arguably they can't do that because, you know, the ICC is part of the headquarters agreement with the UN. I mean, the ICC prosecutor is invited to the United Nations to address the Security Council. The ICC Assembly of States Parties, that's the governing body where all the states parties meet, meets every other year in the United States. There are a lot of things that would violate, you know, U.S. commitments. But I think this kind of, you know, these really over-the-top attacks actually create, you know, a backlash. And, you know, John Bolton is talking about the hard power of the U.S. The U.S. is losing so much soft power by these things that you will see people who are critics of the ICC. I consider myself to be a critic of the ICC, but you rush to defend it in this kind of circumstance. And I think we will see that many of the critics of the ICC will feel more sympathetic because of these over-the-top attacks by John Bolton.
Let's turn our attention in the time that we have remaining to us to Palestine. Bolton announced on September 10th that the U.S. will use any means necessary to protect its citizens and allies from prosecution by the ICC. He supported the closing of the Palestine Liberation Organization's office in Washington, D.C., and he said that the U.S. will, quote, not allow the ICC or any other organization to constrain Israel's right to self-defense. He was referring to Israel's actions in Gaza in 2014 and the Palestinians seeking to use the international court to prosecute Israel. Would you talk about that? And do you think that what Israel did when it invaded Gaza in 2014 was self-defense?
Well, whether or not it was self-defense is not relevant to the question of whether war crimes are being committed. So the ICC is really looking at the question of war crimes. Now, Palestine became a state, invited the ICC to investigate. And so the ICC, because of that, has jurisdiction over, I think, back to 2015, although the Palestinian Authority has asked it to go back to 2014, which includes the conflict in Gaza. So it's not a question of whether or not Israel was right. The question is, have you, you know, targeted civilians? The other question, which many consider important, is whether Israeli settlements constitute a war crime. It is under the ICC statute, it is a war crime to transfer your population into the population of an occupied territory. And so obviously Israel and the United States are, and then the current administration, very nervous about this. If Israel were to investigate the crimes, the alleged crimes that were committed, and in fact, there were crimes probably committed on both sides. I mean, Palestinian rockets into civilian territories in Israel. You know, if there were an adequate investigation by the national authorities into these things, the ICC's jurisdiction would be ousted. And so that is the response that the ICC would hope, and that the creation of the ICC would hope to provoke, is that national authorities, whether it be in Argentina or in Colombia or in the United States or in Israel, that these alleged crimes be pursued by national authorities.
Yeah, but the Israelis are not going to pursue what they did in Gaza. They killed over 500 children, for example, over 3,000 people altogether, and they haven't criticize themselves for what they did. So I think that the Palestine Liberation Organization is likely to go forward and ask for an investigation. Let's say the investigation finds that the Israeli government did commit war crimes and crimes against humanity. What can the ICC do then to enforce the judgment?
Yes, they would have to first determine that, you know, there is a case. I mean, right now we're at the stage of what's called a preliminary investigation, to determine whether or not a formal investigation should go forward. If you have a formal investigation, then the prosecutor would lay charges before a panel of the of ICC judges, and if they just determine that charges were warranted, then specific individuals, not the Israeli government, but you know, specific individuals who are alleged to have committed war crimes could then be indicted. Now, one of the main weaknesses of the ICC and one of the reasons that it has not been as effective is because states have not cooperated in, you know, turning, you know, suspects over to the ICC. So the ICC, for instance, has indicted the president of Sudan for Darfur, and yet he travels the world. One of the main reasons why the ICC has not been as effective. You would then have a situation where the people who are accused of these crimes would be, you know, international fugitives, and the question is, who would turn them over to the court?
In addition to closing the PLO's office, the United States stopped giving money to the United Nations Relief Works Agencies, UNRWA. This cutoff of funding for hospitals and schools in the West Bank and Gaza, which helped some 5 million people, is this in retaliation for the PLO's going to the ICC complaining of Israeli war crimes, or is it a way to set up the PLO for a kind of American-Israeli enforced settlement with the Palestinian? What's your analysis of why they've cut off funding to hospitals and schools?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not a political analyst, but I would suggest it's both. Obviously, the United States has taken a policy decision to make, you know, Palestine bleed and to, you know, to force them to, you know, change their negotiating positions because of, you know, the humanitarian crisis which they're facing. But, of course, it's also, you know, part of one of the griefs that the U.S., even before this, has, you know, laid before the Palestinians, is that they are citing the ICC. And in fact, I have to say other Western allies have not been that strong, the European Union, on this either, trying to kind of persuade the ICC trying to persuade the Palestinians not to go the ICC route. But look, you know, law is law. If we believe in an international order based on rules, and if we believe that that is the best way to, you know, to prevent atrocities and to uphold the rights of victims, then we have to believe that whether the crimes are being committed in Darfur or whether they're being committed in Palestine or whether they're committed in Afghanistan.
I wanted to ask you, if I might, on a personal note, how did you get involved in this kind of international human rights work?
Well, in 1984, I visited Nicaragua. And I was totally blown away by, I went as the guest of an American parish priest in the north of Nicaragua. In his village was being attacked by the U.S.-backed Contras. And I was just blown away by what his parishioners were telling me and asking me to go back and tell people in the United States what I had seen, what the Contras were doing. And I quit my job at the New York State Attorney General's office, and I went back to Nicaragua. That's where I got to know very well Michael Ratner, who really guided me a lot in what I was doing. And I went back to Nicaragua, and I spent 6 months traveling around the country, interviewing witnesses and victims of atrocities by the Contras against Nicaraguan civilians. And my report was on the front page of the New York Times. I was attacked personally by President Ronald Reagan. This was before presidents had a tradition of attacking people, so it was more of a big deal. It led to a temporary cutoff in Contra Aid, and I'd been working in human rights ever since. And this particular work on accountability began with the Pinochet case, also 20 years ago, at the same time as the ICC, when General Pinochet of Chile was arrested in London on a warrant from a Spanish judge for crimes allegedly committed in Chile, and he challenged his arrest before the British courts, I went to London to participate in the House of Lords hearings on behalf of Human Rights Watch. And when the House of Lords ruled that Pinochet could be arrested and prosecuted anywhere in the world, despite the fact that he was a former head of state, you know, that really opened up. First of all, it was a win. And then having been a volunteer attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, I was used to being right and losing. And here we won. We actually upheld the arrest of Augusto Pinochet. And, you know, it was a wake-up call. I described it at the time as a wake-up call for dictators, but it was really a wake-up call for victims and activists around the world who said, well, wait a second, we have a tool, international law, international justice, to bring to book people who seemed out of the reach of justice. And so after Pinochet was worked on, case Duvalier in Haiti. I worked on most recently for 18 years on the case of Hissène Habré, the former dictator of Chad, who was finally convicted by a Senegalese court 2 years ago after almost two decades of work with his victims. Now I'm working on the case of the former dictator of Gambia, Yahya Jammeh.
Attorney Reed Brody, it's really been a pleasure to have you here in the studio. I'm afraid that we've come to an end of our allotted time, but before I let you go, could you tell our listeners how they can keep up with what kind of work you're doing?
Well, I work for Human Rights Watch, a big human rights organization. We have a website, hrw.org, and people can follow me. They can follow me on Twitter at Reed Brody.
Thank you so much, Reed. You take it easy. Thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's my pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Many organizations supporting the water protectors was Greenpeace. As a consequence, they were sued by Energy Transfer Partners and accused of racketeering under the RICO Act, a law originally passed to be used against organized crime. The suit was designed to tie up the resources of Greenpeace, harass them, and cost them money. The lawyers for the corporation are the same firm used by Donald Trump. These legal actions by big corporations are called SLAP suits. This stands for Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation. In recent times, these lawsuits have been proliferating. 2 weeks ago, 18 organizations, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, banded together to fight back. Here to speak with us today is attorney Deepa Panmanabhaa. She is the Assistant General Counsel with Greenpeace since 2011 and is based in Washington, D.C. Deepa is involved in defending Greenpeace against two lawsuits attempting to silence the organization's advocacy work. These lawsuits are brought by Resolute Forest Products and Energy Transfer Partners. She also advises on a variety of legal matters and manages criminal law cases where Greenpeace activists have engaged in civil disobedience. Deepa represents Greenpeace USA in the Protect the Protest Task Force, the recently formed coalition created to confront corporations that file lawsuits designed to silence dissent and provide resources to individuals and groups facing these suits. Attorney Deepa Padmanabhaa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Deepa, you're involved in litigating the case where the Energy Transfer Partners has sued Greenpeace. What are the facts in the case?
Yeah, great. I'll get into the facts, and it's been a pretty busy summer procedurally, so I'll touch on that as well. So in August 2017, Greenpeace was served with a $900 million lawsuit from Energy Transfer Partners, and I'm sure most people are aware Energy Transfer Partners is the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so EPP, or Energy Transfer Partners, they sued under the Federal Racketeering Law, or RICO, alleging that Greenpeace orchestrated the entire resistance movement at Standing Rock. And they allege that Greenpeace generated a campaign of lies about the pipeline, and they manipulated indigenous groups into participating in the resistance. Basically, what their complaint does is it depicts Greenpeace as this ringleader of the resistance, and they deny any leadership role that indigenous groups play. And when you just take a brief look at the complaint, it's very clear that Energy Transfer Partners was trying to sow division between indigenous and environmental groups. So this case was filed in the Federal District Court in North Dakota. And in addition to Greenpeace U.S. and Greenpeace International, the other defendants that were named were BankTrack, which is a small Dutch organization, and the movement known as Earth First. So this summer, as I mentioned earlier, the judge has been quite busy, and due to some of the incredible work of our allies, the judge actually dismissed BankTrack and the Earth First movement from the lawsuit. And for the remaining defendants, the court looked at the complaint and told ETP, listen, in order for me not to dismiss this suit, you have to refile an amended complaint because you failed to plead simple, concise, and direct allegations, which when you looked at this complaint, it's very overly broad allegations that don't have much of a factual basis. So not surprisingly, Energy Transfer Partners went ahead and filed an amended complaint. What Energy Transfer did, rather than following the judge's order, it actually broadened its complaint and added five individuals as defendants, including a Greenpeace employee. And it even added allegations outside of Standing Rock. It added allegations based on the ongoing protests at other EPP pipeline projects in Louisiana and Pennsylvania. And where we're at today is Greenpeace filed a motion to dismiss in early September, and EPP filed its response yesterday, and we're basically waiting for a decision any day now.
What issues are involved, Deepa?
Well, in the original complaint, the issue is the resistance at Standing Rock, what that was about, who was behind it. What ETP alleges is that Greenpeace spread all of these lies, that all of the resistance, all of the issues with the water protections was actually a bunch of lies that were generated by Greenpeace, and that these lies were used to solicit donations from our donors. They allege that we were part of this large criminal conspiracy and that we brought in all these other groups, including all of the indigenous groups, to basically get them to engage in this resistance movement.
Greenpeace is also a defendant in the case where the Resolute Forest Company is suing you. And that's a logging company, the largest one in Canada. And that company is cutting down Canada's boreal forests. And they've charged Greenpeace with extorting its customers and defrauding Greenpeace's own donors. They call you a predatory pack preying on legitimate businesses, and they call you a parasite. They go on to say that maximizing donations, not saving the environment, is Greenpeace's true objective. And that's written in the complaint filed against you. What was your response?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at both complaints, you'll see many parallel allegations, which is no surprise because both lawsuits were brought by the same law firm, which I know we'll touch on later. But in that suit, it's the same kind of thing. They accuse Greenpeace of engaging in a misinformation campaign, spreading lies about the company's forest practices and its violation of Indigenous rights. And they say that we raise money off of these donations. They claim that we're a global fraud and raising money is our primary objective. And so what happened in that case was that in May of this year, we actually had a motion to dismiss hearing. Well, let me back up. The case was actually dismissed last year, and Resolute decided to refile. They filed an amended complaint, and we had a hearing on that at the end of May, and we expect a decision any day on that case. And we're very confident that we'll have a similar result as we did the first time around, which was a complete dismissal of the case.
The law firm, Cassowitz, Benson, and Torres, is the attorney for Energy Transfer Partners. They're also using the RICO, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. Wasn't that law originally intended to be used against organized crime? And tell us about this law firm.
Yes, exactly. So Cassowitz, Benson, and Torres is, as you said, the law firm behind both lawsuits, and they're actually historically have been Trump's go-to law firm. So, you know, we see a lot of attacks on the movements happening through both the private and the government sectors. And so what they're trying to do in bringing this RICO lawsuit is really intimidate activists. They're trying to send a message that, hey, if you speak out against corporations, you could become subject to this lawsuit. And what the danger of the RICO suit is, they're really going after our ability to organize at a very fundamental level. They're saying that if you stand in solidarity, which is exactly what Greenpeace did at Standing Rock, if you mobilize, if you organize, you could be charged with racketeering, a law, as you said, that was used to prosecute the mafia. So it's completely a scare tactic that's being used to intimidate not just those who have been served with the lawsuit or named in the lawsuit, but all those who are watching. And we think that this is largely in part because a corporation like ECP, they see the resistance that's developing with these other pipeline projects. They recognize that if another movement like the Standing Rock resistance happens, there is no way that they're going to be able to continue with their work. So they're trying to put a stop to it now and just intimidate everybody that's watching.
Do you suspect that the plaintiffs don't care if they win, that they just want to cause you trouble and expense and try to impact your donor base?
Yes, I mean, that's exactly it. Basically, there's several things that's clear that's happening. One, they're trying to scare us and others from speaking out. They're also trying to drain our resources and distract us with a costly and lengthy legal battle and silence us and send a message to all those who are watching about who's in control. That's the nature of these suits, and when you actually look at the complaint, you can see that there's not a lot of thought that's actually put into what's on paper, because what happens is with these types of suits, by filing it, you know, if I wake up one day and I get a 187-page complaint against me and somebody knocks on the door and throws me with that, it's very reasonable to think that I would be scared to speak out, and that's exactly what they're trying to accomplish with these complaints.
187-page complaint?
That is the length of the Energy Transfer Partners complaint.
It's unbelievable. 2 weeks ago, Greenpeace and the Center for Constitutional Rights and 16 other organizations came together to fight these lawsuits. And these lawsuits are called SLAP suits. What's a SLAP suit? And talk about the coalition that came together.
Yeah, Yes, of course. So SLAP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And what these lawsuits are they're intended to censor, intimidate, and silence critics by burdening them with the cost of a legal defense. And the idea is that just by filing the suit, it will result in the silencing of dissent, the silencing of criticism. They're often disguised as defamation cases, and what's specifically unique about SLAP is the objective is not to win in court, but it's to tie up defendants in burdensome litigation that's so costly that the end result will be silence. These two suits, the Energy Transfer Partners suit and the Resolute suit, are very classic cases of SLAP suits. And basically what we want to show corporations, law firms, everybody who's thinking about using these tactics are that not only will these tactics not work to intimidate us, they're actually making us stronger, they're making us louder, they're making us bolder. And that's really where the Protect the Protest Task Force was born from. We saw this trend in these dangerous suits being filed and across movements from, as you mentioned, Center for Constitutional Rights, to Greenpeace, to ACLU, groups across sectors have come together to say that you will not intimidate us, you will not scare us, and you're just going to make us more powerful by bringing these suits. And one thing that I think is important to mention is that corporations and law firms are looking at increasing this trend. Michael Bowie, who is a partner on both lawsuits with Katowice, he has publicly stated that he is shopping this tactic around, and he believes that other corporations will be interested in filing these suits. So we really want to come together. Now is this critical moment for us to come together to say this won't work. And, you know, one thing that's important to mention about SLAP is that they're nothing new, and they often don't get the public's attention because they're often filed against individual small community groups, you know, environmental justice groups that are, you know, 2-3 people. And unfortunately, when filed against those types of groups and those individuals, they often have the intended effect of silencing. They don't often get to the phase that we are with our ETP and Resolute suits because these groups don't have the resources to fight, to hire attorneys to be able to fight these suits. So really, our goal is to send a message that when you go after one of us, you go after all of us.
Well, Deepa, you're the Assistant General Counsel for Greenpeace. If you prevail against the Resolute Forest Company, and if you prevail against Energy Transfer Partners, do these plaintiffs that have brought this SLAP suit, do they suffer any damages? Do they have to pay your expenses?
Well, unfortunately, at this time, there is no federal anti-SLAP statute. So let me back up. The way that in these cases we could recover attorney's fees are if the states have what are called anti-SLAP statutes, which basically are these laws that have been put into place to deter plaintiffs from bringing suits. So what these types of suits? So what they do is they increase the burden that a plaintiff has to fulfill in order to move forward with the suit, and they also impose a penalty to deter plaintiffs from bringing these types of suits. So in Resolute, actually, the first time around, we were granted attorney's fees because the case was decided in California, which has an anti-SLAP statute. So in those instances, although the case, you know, although we're still waiting for the final outcome, in the first iteration, we were granted attorney's fees for the state claims. Unfortunately, in North Dakota, where the Energy Transfer Partners suit was filed, there is no anti-SLAP statute. So what we're seeing is these corporations are looking around to basically forum shop and look for places in states that don't have anti-SLAP statutes. So in Resolute Forest Products, the first time around, they actually filed their case in Georgia, which at that time did not have an anti-SLAP statute, and that was very strategic. We were able to get it moved to California. And, you know, our hope is that one day there will be a federal anti-SLAP statute so that corporations won't be allowed to just form shop for the, you know, for the most convenient jurisdiction for them.
That's my hope, too. Before we wrap it up, Deepa, I wanted to ask you on a personal note, how did you get involved in this kind of legal work?
Well, so with these SLAP suits, it wasn't really by choice. We became defendants in both of these suits. But But I do want to emphasize that it's actually, in a strange way, it's kind of a badge of honor, because the fact that these corporations are targeting Greenpeace and targeting the movements really shows that they're scared, that we're doing something right, that the work and the advocacy and the resistance is growing, that it's strong, and that they're desperate to silence us. And so while I got into this particular area of work not necessarily by choice, it's amazing to see how strong the movement has become, how much support we've gotten from allies. So that's really what the SLAP is. And with the general defense of activists with civil disobedience, I mean, I have always felt that that the law is a tool, and that we have people working inside the system, working outside the system, and Greenpeace really provided this sort of balance to do both and really put our legal skills to change the system.
How can listeners learn more about what Greenpeace is doing and what the coalition is doing? How do they stay in touch with your work?
For Greenpeace specifically, you can always visit our website. And with the Protect the Protest, we actually just had our formal launch a few weeks ago. We have a website, protecttheprotest.org, and have a presence on Facebook and Twitter. And really right now what our focus on is we really want to generate resources for those who might face these types of lawsuits, for how you can prevent those lawsuits. And I also want to emphasize that the Protect the Protest Task Force is a very large component of legal support. But with these types of suits, it's very important to also have campaign and communication support, because, as I said earlier, the intent is not to win in the courtroom. So often with these types of suits, you see PR attacks. You see all kinds of attacks that are happening in the media. And what's important is that you also have the ability to campaign, to draw attention so the public can become aware of these suits, and you can engage in such a way that, you know, corporations see this as a failing tactic. And that's really what the task force is focused on right now, and we're going to be setting up training to address that.
Well, more power to you, Deepa. Thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and we wish you all the best and good luck to you on the lawsuits.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Was Smithsonian Folkways recording player Eli Smith on the banjo.
Mm-hmm.